Chad McCullough's Modal Horizons, the music of Jim Knapp, featuring Jay Thomas, on Friday, May 8th, 8 p.m. at the Borough. Chicago native Jim Knapp had a long and storied career with affiliations as varied as John Cage, Sam Rivers, Anthony Braxton, Manfred Eicher, and Gil Evans. For the first time in many years, his music will be performed in the Midwest with a world-class 13-piece ensemble led by Chicago trumpeter Chad McCulloch, along with trumpeter and saxophonist Jay Thomas. More information can be found at bluestemjazz.org. Bluestem Jazz presents Chad McCulloch's Modal Horizons, the music of Jim Knapp, featuring Jay Thomas, on Friday, May 8th, 8 p.m. at the Burr Oak. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
Notion Machine on WORT 89.9 FM, listener-supported community radio in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Catherine Gardens, and I'll be your host this evening. My guest tonight is UW professor and genetics researcher Francisco Pellegrini. Francisco is a professor and department chair at the UW-Madison Departments of Genetics and Medical Genetics. He earned his PhD in medical genetics at MIT and completed postdoctoral research at the Max Planck Institute for Developmental Biology in Germany. His research at UW-Madison focuses on cellular and developmental genetics and conservation genetics. Professor Pellegrini, thank you so much for joining me on WORT.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. So first, I always like to ask guests who are doing fascinating work, how did you become interested in the study of genetics?
Yeah, I was always interested in nature, zoology, even more the study of animal behavior in the wild. But then I was also interested in biophysics and that more hard science aspect. And so when genetics came along, I really liked the mixture of nature and mathematics and modeling, things like that.
And what exactly is cellular and developmental genetics?
Well, it's something that it's a combination of understanding how cells work and also in the context of an organism. So if you think a simple example would be an early embryo. You get an egg and it gets fertilized by a sperm cell. Then you have what's called a zygote, which is a one-cell embryo, but that has to divide. And those are really large cells, for example, that come from a big egg, but they get smaller and smaller until they get to a regular cell size. And at the same time, they form how the organism patterns itself. So it has a head, a tail, and all that has to be connected. And it really is a combination of what's happening inside the cells and how they talk to each other to generate the organism, so they're really highly related. Now, some people work more on the aspect of cellular from inside of the cell, what the cells do in the inside. They have what's called a cytoskeleton, a skeleton inside the cell that has tubules to generate form, to move. They also activate gene expression, so that all happens inside the cell, but there's also interaction from one cell to another to form the basis of the embryo. And so there's that continuum between what's really inside and that, and then how they talk to each other to generate a form that is bigger than that, which is essentially the organism that keeps developing. So it's all that continuum. And it's related. So that's what I studied. And right now I'm actually at the intersection of that, just because the early embryos, the cells are so big that they essentially are the organism.
Is that what they call that continuum? Is that what they call the germline? Or is that something completely different?
That's a little bit different concept, which is the germline is basically, it is a continuum. The germline is thought to be the continuum for the species. When you have the early embryo and it starts to divide, some of the cells are going to be fated to become the germline, and the other ones are going to be fated to become the soma. And the soma is what forms the body. And so your limited lifespan, one generation body, and the germline is basically what's going to generate the gametes for the next generation. So people say very readily that the germline lasts forever. So it's immortal. Yeah.
And how does the study of cellular and developmental genetics inform and or support conservation genetics?
Yeah, well, this is really a new field. The field of conservation genetics more traditionally has been in the assessment of genetic diversity, for example, in the wild, and the ways that we can maintain that at the ecosystem level. And the idea that we can use more molecular techniques that are cellular and developmental techniques is more recent. Well, actually, it's not that recent, but it's really more recently applied. And so if you think, for example, of the San Diego Zoo, back in the 1970s, they were ready, even without knowing exactly how to use them, they had the foresight to freeze samples of endangered species. And so their samples are over 40 years old that have been frozen in liquid nitrogen for 40 years. And just in the last year, about 2 years ago, they used one sample to essentially create a black-footed ferret, which is an endangered species in the United States. And that sample, there were two samples that were frozen together. So this was a collaboration of three institutions, Revive and Restore, ViaGen, and San Diego Zoo. And then they were able to bring back a live black-footed ferret that had three times more genetic diversity than existed because the existing population went through a severe bottleneck. So then this kind of is like a blueprint for how this cellular technology can be used, because now we have a way to get samples that are stored and then, in a sense, preserve that biodiversity so that it can be used later. And if you think about a population will only be healthy if it has biodiversity. That's for two reasons. You want to avoid maybe some of the gene variants that are perhaps not optimal. You want to avoid them to be homozygous, in a sense, so you want to avoid only having those copies, because that would perhaps cause some defects that would make you less fit, less healthy. But also you want to have genetic diversity so you can defend yourself against pathogens as well as you can. So for those two reasons, genetic diversity in a sense is population health for animal species. So this is a way, the cellular technology is a way to bring that genetic diversity into the population and store it for a long time at a time that we may need it later in the future.
As I understand it, what you just said is the reason that it's important to harvest the cells now when there's still a lot of diversity in the line, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this is the time that we can do it when the diversity is here is the best time to harvest it. If we wait too long, we may be with the same problem that we have now with some of the very highly endangered species, that we do not have that genetic diversity. So precisely for that reason. And people say that there's a rule called 5500, which you want to have at least 50 individuals to prevent a really severe case of, for example, inbreeding, or 500 to just prevent random changes over time. But we probably need thousands of samples to really represent genetic diversity. And even then, we have to think pretty hard. It wouldn't be the same as having 1,000 samples of bees that may be really highly related than 1,000 samples of another species that may be more widely distributed. So we have to think hard about it, but we need lots of samples to represent that diversity. The advantage of this cellular technologies now is that we can, because as people may be aware, we have now a new technology where we can transform somatic cells, which are easy to get. You could even think about hair samples or a tiny little biopunch or even a prickle of blood. We can turn those into this what's called induced pluripotent cells, which are essentially stem cells. And this is a new technology we didn't have before. So in the old days, people thought about biopreservation as maybe storing eggs and sperm, which is highly invasive, not appropriate for endangered species at all, and difficult to do, even if it wasn't endangered. But now we can literally connect with field studies, for example, get a tiny biopunch of a skin, make the stem cells, and store it for the future and when they may be needed.
So it's really this new technology that is enabling all of this work.
Yeah, basically. Exactly. Yeah, it Amazing. Really allows connecting this in a way that is practical and that can be really scaled up.
So tell me about the Great Lakes Biobank Initiative at UW-Madison and your partnership with the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies.
Yeah, so, with Paul Robbins, we have had conversations and tried to get this started for a number of years, and we have had also support from UW-Madison. in the form of one of those seed grants, UW2020, a few years ago. And we've also worked with other investigators on campus, including Bill Murphy and others that are field biologists. And we have been proposing the idea that we could establish essentially a model for biopreservation. And one of the questions that came up very early on with the conversation with Paul Robbins at the Nelson is, how do you prioritize? How do you prioritize the species that are important that you want to biopreserve? Why this species as opposed to another, right? Just because it's fuzzy and cute and or not, right? And so one of the ideas for biopreservation, the prioritization that came up, was the idea of land ethics, which really fit also well with Aldo Leopold's ideas. And so then at one point we actually were, and I still go to Costa Rica more with students, but at one point we were stuck in the pandemic, and then we thought, well, why don't we do it here in Wisconsin? And this could be a model for ecosystem level preservation at the level of geography and a land ethic. So that's where we started thinking, let's do this and show that we can really biopreserve an entire area. And so we would, of course, start with the species that are at the higher trophic levels, but try to go down and try to get as many samples as we can, get as many species as we can preserved for the future.
And there are certainly no shortage of organisms, animals, and otherwise in the Great Lakes area that are endangered or threatened.
Yeah, there are some that, yeah, there's many animals that are endangered not only regionally but also federally endangered. And there's also some species like the walleye that maybe is there's populations in the Great Lakes that are federally endangered elsewhere. That was a sturgeon. That there's more here in Wisconsin. There's a lot of species that mammals and birds that are both endangered, both regionally and federally, or one or the other, and they're all valuable. And Wisconsin represents a case where climate change may be changing the constitution of the region. And there's not a lot to move upwards if the climate change towards the lakes. And so that might be. And so for those reasons, the whole concept of management also becomes important. And what we'd like to do is set it up so that we have a model for how to do that on a whole ecosystem level. And getting back to that question about the Nelson, I think Paul Robbins is particularly interested in the use of new technology in a way that is justifiable. And so the concept of ethics. And in this case, the idea that this can help animal populations seems like a really good model for the use of new technology and its ethical basis.
You mentioned the issue of ethics, so let's talk about that a little bit from the perspective of the Nelson Institute. What does it mean, and what are the initiatives to ethically harvest genetic material?
Sure. Well, I think this is an ongoing conversation, the whole concept of ethics. And I can't speak necessarily for Nelson, but I think there's various aspects that come up. And the first one is this a good allocation of resources? So why not just allocate why not preserve the ecosystem and just put all your efforts there rather than trying to do this biopreservation? And the answer there is, we're trying to use, from an ethical perspective, is we're trying to develop all the tools that will be available in the future to keep that management. And when it comes to resources, these kinds of technologies can also bring additional partners into the equation, that they may be donors, that they may provide even more support for conservation initiatives, including preservation of the environment. So that's one of the ethical aspects is that. The other ethical aspect that comes up is the idea of, are we playing God, right? So when you think about a seed bank, and we're all very familiar with the concept of seed banks, and they have been in history just developed at the level of individuals all the way to institutions, and there's a famous one in north of Norway, but people are comfortable with that, and that's because plant makes seeds that last a long time. But then when you start talking about storing cells for a long time, that becomes, it's harder to see some people are concerned that this is not natural, but the rationale of having the banks is the exact same rationale. And so then you have to start asking, what is the ethical argument for not using this technology? Because animal populations will suffer. Animal populations do suffer when they don't have enough population health. If you think about the Florida panther, for example, they went down to 12 and they had developmental defects. And they could not reproduce, and they were essentially fated to extinction. This is not a healthy population. It is represented by unhealthy individuals also who are suffering. So there is also a cost of not acting, and the cost comes from individuals. It also comes from species, And then the species also, we know that the health of an ecosystem depends on that network. And as soon as you start losing one or another species, you're going to lose also the health of the entire ecosystem. So by helping species, you're helping individuals, but you also help the entire network of the ecosystem. So that is the rationale, using that toolkit that will become available.
It sounds like conversations are being had about how this dovetails with natural selection. If you invigorate a species in its current cellular form, will it be able to thrive and survive in a changed ecosystem? Does that make sense?
No, it makes a lot of sense. Okay. I think even just yesterday, they were on the radio, I was listening to a reference to studies about corals and whether there's selection or studies to select corals that are more heat resistant, for example, right? And so as you get climate change, we will have changes in representation of population, and then some of the variants in the population may be able to allow that species to survive better. And that is part of what conservation geneticists think about. That is not necessarily part of the intrinsic aspect of biopreservation right now. I mean, you could think about the idea, yes, if you want to, let's make sure that if you have a population that is across a special, particular geographical field, that you want to make sure you have the ones that are perhaps more at the lower part, maybe that more adapted to the heat, make sure you have those. Right. So that those kinds of thoughts are definitely important, and perhaps that we should develop those a lot more. But the idea of biopreservation right now is we have the genetic diversity, and it's not just about climate change. It's just about a lot of other things like pathogens. And for example, these frogs that were affected by this fungus in Central America, and a lot of them have become extinct or threatened. Some of them have become extinct, and a lot of them are threatened. Some of these, we know that by having more genetic diversity, they're more resistant. They simply have better ways to fight pathogens. So what we're thinking is genetic diversity as a whole, and then yes, there are a lot of ways that you can think to incorporate climate change into the equation in the same way that you can try to incorporate preserve zones. What are the regional preserve zones and how those interact with what you're trying to do at the ecosystem level? And also the cellular techniques, because to bring back some of these cells from the biobank, you may actually need a related species. And so you can actually use that similarity to help bring back endangered species using a non-endangered species. And so are all of those protected? So there's going to be a few things to look at. And what we're hoping is working with other people across the globe to establish those principles.
So I'm curious, what does a typical day look like for you?
Well, I mean, I think the question is what is going to look like. Well, one question is what does it look like now, but also what is going to be look like for people that are in this field in the future.
Perfect.
And,
yeah.
Right. And so right now we are really trying to incorporate ourselves into these conversations that are global, and that involves. Personally, I teach a course that I started with these technologies. It's a well-received course because you have technologies that are very cellular and molecular that apply even to regenerative medicine. It's the same kind of methods that you would use to take a cell and turn into an organoid or eventually perhaps even make an organ for a person. It's the same kind of technology. So people that care about conservation, care about molecular, they learn at the same time. At the same time, you raise awareness. Just last 2 weeks ago, we went to Costa Rica. We visited preserves, and you raise awareness for students. And that really is life-changing for a lot of us. And so all that's part of the equation right now. We try to get funding. So we just submitted this grant 2 weeks ago to try to get the support for the project. And in that particular application, we had about 20 people that were involved. So kind of get all those networks, get all those interactions. And the nice thing about this topic is that almost everybody, or essentially everybody I know, wants to help. So it's very easy to get support, at least from the level faculty. So I do a lot of those things. We work in the lab. I work on fish. And we try to set up the system so that they can be models for the entire approach. So, for example, if you have a cell from a tail clip from a fish that you literally get a little tiny punch or even a nibble that would happen in the wild anyway, the fish can regenerate that very easily within a week or 10 days, get the entire tail back. In the meantime, you have this small amount of cells that you can grow into a cell line. Can we turn that into a germ cell using the right factors? So we study what RNAs, what genes are required to make a germ cell. And once you have that germ cell, can you put it back into an embryo and regenerate that cell that was in your tail clip in the first place. And so, and that embryo may even be an embryo from a different species. And we know, for example, that quail and chick, you can have a chicken carrying quail eggs, I mean, quail germ cells, and maybe even make quail gametes. We know that is possible, and that's because those are relatively related species. So the idea is to test these principles in the lab. We also have some frogs, so we take, my life is sort of working with this, with these models, and then perhaps someday we can go to the wild, and well, the hope is that we can go to the wild, and let's just say there's a lake, Lake Inle in Burma, that has these endangered fish species that are the ones we have in the lab. Can we assess the biodiversity there? Can we bring them back? Can we recreate it and show that this actually works?
It must be a challenge to focus on one thing at a time. Is that a challenge, or is it
That's a great question, and it is. But yes, but at some point, this is the idea of having a model system in terms of the lab. So we have fish, and zebrafish is a very popular model system, very strong. There's a lot of information that you can use. But even at the level of biopreservation, right now we're proposing to just focus on two species as a model. And we thought of American martens and red foxes. And so they say, okay, let's start with that. And the Weizmann Center is also helping us with their core, with the stem cell core. And let's just start with that, and then we just keep expanding. And then, but you're right, there's so much to do, and you want to pick your areas. For example, perhaps Costa Rica and Nepal, and that partly is because we have collaborators there and some resources, South Africa, Madagascar. So maybe you have to pick, but there's a rationale for that that you want to try to follow.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the Great Lakes, because there's lots of research possibilities within the Great Lakes watershed as well.
Exactly. And the other thing about the Great Lakes is that it's not as complex as a rainforest. And so it actually might be more tractable if you want it as a model. If you want to start with something, you want something that can work and not something that is just so overwhelmingly complex that it may not work at all.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah. We don't have time to cover this in depth, but can you speak a bit on how you're storing this information and the technology there?
Yeah, the idea here is Bill Murphy is a professor in biomedical engineering, and he studies what's called bio-inspired preservation. And so their work, for example, they have been using mineralization, using depositions of minerals, and that could help encase either cells or RNAs or DNAs. And so the idea is that you use solutions that already exist present in the wild to try to preserve something in a way that is more efficient. And so, for example, if you go and bone is able to preserve material. The reason keratin is also very able to do that. Reason, for example, we can get DNA from mammoths is because they're encased in the keratin of the hair. And so those are what's called bio-inspired solution. And one of the ideas that we have pursued with in collaboration with him is the use of tardigrades. Tardigrades are these water bears. They're these little invertebrates that have survived all mass extinctions. They can survive out in space. They can desiccate and form this little what's called a tun. And this... and then come back and rehydrate. And they're able to do that because they activate all these genes that allow them to, essentially prevent them from being dehydrated. These are genes that, in a sense, they help to, they act as little sponges and keep that moisture in. The proteins are they're called intrinsically disordered proteins, and they're unstructured. So they essentially make like almost like an oil face in these embryos, I mean these eggs. And they can last over 100 years like that. And so we looked at the genes that are expressed in the targets as they get dehydrated. And we have been expressing those genes in cells and seeing if the cells are more resistant. And indeed, there seem to have some resistance. And we like to identify the specific genes that are most important. And if you think about the germline, I'd love to study the germline of the tardigrades so that we can preserve the germline also for a very long time. But the applications of the Murphy Lab have also a lot of biomedical importance. For example, the preservation of vaccines or RNA or vaccines, for example, that could be at room temperature. And the whole idea is that you can biopreserve without needing, for example, liquid nitrogen. And so it would make the accessibility of vaccines across the world much better.
Very interesting. Paul Robbins, who's the dean of the Nelson Institute, he and I have agreed that we'll touch base in a year or so on this end of the project. But talking about the work with the sovereign nations and the ethics and data collection, can you just touch on that really briefly, and then we'll go more in depth with Paul?
Sure. Yeah. So the idea is the fairness of where does the who has the sovereignty of the of biodiversity, of any kind of data, and in this case, the biodiversity of a region. And we know that about 80% of all biodiversity in the planet is in lands are controlled or protected by indigenous peoples. And so it's not, and certain countries, for example, have put a lot, for example, Costa Rica has put a lot of effort into protecting biodiversity. And the idea is to, until now, we've had essentially a colonialist attitude where we can just go and take, right? And that's not ethically correct, of course. And so the idea is to work with indigenous and local communities in a dialogue that is upfront, that is from the very beginning and not retroactive, and make sure that we have ways in which these kinds of conversations, including how to biopreserve, where to biopreserve, where to keep the samples, where to keep the information, that all is part of the dialogue that is respects their sovereignty. And that's also the only way that it's going to work. It's not only fair, but it's only the only practical way that it's going to work. And so when we think about biobanks, and because biodiversity is so across the globe, then we're also thinking about a decentralized network of biobanks where this preservation may be in different parts of the world. We may have multiple samples as agreed by indigenous and local communities. And this is also why having really efficient ways of doing the work is important, because then that can be shared and that can help that whole decentralized network.
Is there anything that we haven't discussed up to this point that you think is important to this work?
Well, I think what we haven't talked about is how as a society we commit, or one thing I'd like to point out,
please.
As a society, how do we commit to the long-term preservation of our planet? And these are all very long-term solutions. And as we know that a lot of decisions happen in the short term, or they can change. And so we need to find ways that we are able to manage biodiversity for the long term. And this is why having the dialogue, and both from the ethical and the social perspective, and also having the tools is important. The other thing that perhaps is definitely worth pointing out is this whole conversation of, like, say, the black-footed ferret, which is, there's already a few ferrets, and they have there in the hands of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And they are really potentially really going to help the species. But so this is a really valuable technique, I think, but it's also marred by the a lot of opposition, which I think, which I completely see, of to bringing back very long lost species, like what's called the extinction. And there's a company out there trying to bring a few species that became extinct. And I'm not against the extinction, but that's not the topic that we're talking about. I think if the species was lost not too long ago, where we can justify that it happened because humans did it, say after the Industrial Revolution, or let's just say species that we know were lost in, you know, these large birds in New Zealand, for example, there potentially could be a justification for that if there's an ecosystem. If there's no ecosystem, that probably is really hard to justify, of course. But what we're talking about with these banks is not that. It's not like really bringing back a species. What we're talking about is really the having the biodiversity so that you can reinvigorate a species that exists as it is. And it's relatively thriving, but it could go down into what's called this extinction vortex. And so we're trying to, so this is a more of a managing tool that we want to have in the future, so that if there's some large event, we can potentially reinvigorate the species. And so I think that's a really important distinction that also addresses the ethical aspects of it, because the ecosystem is there. And so that we want to do is keep that ecosystem strong with these tools.
Very good. Well, it's very important work, and I want to thank you for the research that you're doing and the work you're doing at UW, and thanks for joining me on WORT today.
It's a privilege to work on this. As I mentioned at the very beginning, I always love nature, so for me, it's a pleasure to do this, and thanks so much for having me.
You have been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm Catherine Garvins. My guest tonight was Francisco Pellegrini, professor and geneticist at the UW-Madison. We discussed the Great Lakes Biobank Initiative, which he is leading in close collaboration with the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Up next is Radio Literature with Melvin Hinton. Thanks for listening and have a great evening.
Are you a fan of classical music, especially early music? Do you enjoy hearing it on the radio?
WORT is now seeking a volunteer to join the hosts of Musica Antiqua, a long-running program highlighting the origins of classical music from the medieval era through the Renaissance and Baroque periods.
If you're free early Sunday mornings, we hope you will join us. Hosting a show on WORT includes choosing what to play, typing in your playlist, on-air announcing, and basic audio engineering.
You don't need radio experience, just a passion for this style of music and the willingness to work with us to increase and engage the many listeners and supporters in this show's early morning audience.
You can share your appreciation for this ageless art form by joining our 8 to 11 Sunday morning classical lineup. Volunteer applications are available at the station or online at wortfm.org.
WORT is an equal opportunity, affirmative action organization, and members of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply.
Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on radio literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. My guest is Heather Rankin. Besides being a wonderful actress, a wonderful reader, a wonderful theater consultant, because that's more or less how I thought of her, mainly when I first met her.
Sure.
Because you were the consultant for somebody who was directing a play.
Yeah.
And so she's all.